Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a bi-weekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. The Monterey Bay is the crown jewel of Central California. For well over a century, the bay has been exploited for a myriad of purposes. Today, it needs protection and conservation. This is especially the case with its fish and fisheries, which provide a vital source of food but are vulnerable to tastes and markets. My guest today on Sustainability Now is Melissa Mahoney, Executive Director of the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust. Prior to taking on the job in 2022, Melissa was a conservation practitioner working across state, federal policy forums, helping to apply digital technologies in fisheries, and building partnerships for experimental fisheries, such as rockfish hook and line in Monterey Bay. Melissa Mahoney, thank you for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe you could tell us about the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust and what is its mission and what does it do?
The Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust is a local nonprofit. We're just 10 years old this year, and we are about putting more local seafood on more local plates. And we accomplish that by doing sort of three things-ish. We are about growing a local seafood movement. So that's about consumer awareness and helping people source where they can buy local seafood, which can be hard sometimes. Secondly, we want to empower fishermen and women to be more successful in the management process, to really have a voice. And so we help them get education and trainings and get connected to the right people to share their knowledge, because they really are the stewards of the resource. Number three is we have some community programs, our biggest being our community seafood program that started during COVID. And that's where we purchase seafood from local fishermen and businesses, and we have that donated to six local food bank and food relief groups in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties. And so that takes up the bulk of our work, is those three areas of supporting the local seafood movement, supporting fishermen and businesses, and helping to get equitable seafood access going in our region.
Do you actually, someone on the staff actually goes and buys the fish and then trucks it?
Yeah, no, we don't do that. We work with seafood partners. So they might be individual fishermen, or they are fishing businesses that aggregate, that buy seafood from local fishermen and sort of aggregate it and send it out. So we work with four local, they're called community supported fisheries. They aggregate the seafood that's landed here, and then they actually will process it however it needs to be. Usually it's individual frozen fillets that most food banks want. And so they will process and package those, and then they will distribute to the food banks in the course of their delivery. So they do all that for us, and they give us a fair market rate, and we help create that additional sort of market, local market channel for them. And then they feel really good about being able to deliver to local food banks. And they really like being part of the program, even though it's not a profitable to them, but it's just part about being a community that helps each other out.
Mm-hmm. Let's get back to the basics. Okay. What's your background, and how did you get into the fisheries conservation business?
Well, my background is kind of funny in that I grew up in Colorado. So I grew up in a landlocked state between the desert and the mountains and the rivers, but mm-hmm. I've always had this deep love for the ocean. So even as a kid, the first time I saw the ocean and was around it, there was just something about it that drew me in. And so, you know, my whole academic career, I aimed my path to eventually live on the coast. And I did come out here about 25 years ago to go to graduate school at Moss Landing Marine Labs. I have a master's degree in marine science. I had every intention of being a fisheries biologist. I was very concerned about the conservation of our oceans and protecting them. But my career path took some very interesting turns. Actually, when I started talking with fishermen, I definitely had a bias at the beginning just because of the stories that you hear and the narrative you hear kind of in the media about how there's overfishing and fishermen are the ones doing it. And so I had a bias against them. But in the course of my studies and some of my early work, I needed to talk with them about the fisheries that they were involved in to better understand how they worked. And in the process of that, I became aware that number one, they care just as much about the ocean as I did, and that impressed me. And number two, they knew things about the fish and the ecosystem and the way that the ocean and the tides work that just really blew me away. I had been in grad school for 3.5 years, and I thought I knew a lot, and they knew more than I did. They just had a different way of articulating it, but it really changed the way that I saw myself being a conservation practitioner was not someone to go be at battle and try to cut these guys out of the equation. It was really, I really wanted to see, well, how can fishermen still harvest seafood and be contributing members of our coastal economy and also be the stewards of the resource? And therefore, we have conservation and we have profitable fisheries economy. That's really, really where I've been trying to work the last 20 years, whether it's policy or projects like the Fisheries Trust helping to stand that up. That's really my sweet spot.
When we talk about Monterey Bay, I mean, how far out into the Pacific does the space extend?
You mean the fishing activity or
Yeah, the
management of it
fishing
or?
activity, because when you talked about, you mentioned the accusation of depletion of fisheries, and my sense has always been that this is largely the work of large fishing operation kinds of things. Do you work with any really large fishing operations?
Not anymore, and not really ever. So, I guess the way that you can think about fishing activity in our oceans is that the bigger the boat, the further it can go. And so, we have a small scale fishing fleet, 20 to 30 foot size boats, and they can do day trips. Maybe they could do an overnight at another port. And then you have the bigger fleet that can go out into federal waters, which is from 3 miles offshore to 200 miles. That's our exclusive economic zone. Those bigger boats they can stay out for a week. And then you have the tuna and the swordfish boats that they have to go chase the fish around, and they might be out for a couple weeks at a time and have enough fuel and enough crew and food to really go out far. We have boats that go between Hawaii and California chasing the tuna, and we'll deliver it to whichever port they happen to be closest to. And then you have the foreign fleet, which really was, in before we had our 200-mile limit in the 70s, you had Russian fleet, Chinese fleet. We had a lot of fleets that were coming in and fishing our waters because they were plentiful. And that's where a lot of countries started creating these limits and pushing international fleets out into the high seas. So that's really where a lot of the trouble still is because there isn't enough monitoring and enforcement and traceability of high seas fishing. But when you're talking about fishing off the coast of California and the coast of Monterey Bay, we have some of the most stringent regulations and the most enforcement and monitoring, really, I think, anywhere in the world. So I think our fisheries here are quite sustainable because they're well managed and the fishermen have to comply with the regulations or they won't be in business anymore.
Well, the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust seems to me to be an unusual organization in the world of conservation. I mean, I'm reasonably familiar with, what's out there, and it seems more hybrid. Most marine and fishery-centered organizations focus on conservation alone, and you
Yes.
guys are committed. You call them sustainable fisheries. You suggest that you have a commitment to both the fish and the fishers. And how did you arrive at that, let's just say that compromise? How did that come about?
Yes, I was actually there at the beginning because 10 years ago, or 11 years ago, I was working for the Nature Conservancy, and part of my job when I first got hired was to help figure out how to establish an organization like this in Monterey, because the Nature Conservancy, due to some of their activities to help improve the West Coast groundfish fishery, they ended up owning a whole lot of fishing quota or fishing rights when the fishery transitioned into what we call a catch share system. It made that transition in 2011. And so, trying to keep it top level for a moment, the Fisheries Trust was born out of the need to cede this quota back into the community where the Nature Conservancy had originally bought up some permits and some trawler vessels to reduce habitat damage and do some other things about 10 years prior to this. So I was there at the beginning trying to think about what leaders in the community would pull together to do this. And it was really the city of Monterey and the harbor master, who at the time was very involved in trying to figure out how do we have a fishing industry that is sustainable, that can sustain itself and also protect the resource and kind of strike that balance. And you also had groups like the Nature Conservancy and the Environmental Defense Fund, who are conservation organizations, but they actually, their sweet spot is, and that's probably where I learned it because I work for both of those, but where they really wanted to figure out, well, how can we align ocean health and sustainability with profitability? And that was bringing those people together and knowing that conservation of the resource was an important value and principle, but having a way to support and encourage sort of revitalizing our fishing communities and our fisheries that had collapsed in the year 2000 when the groundfish fishery collapsed and was actually declared a disaster and closed because you had 9 stocks of rockfish and flatfish that were declared overfished. So it was really a comeback of that fishery, which has really been the backbone of fishing activity on the West Coast, because that's a year-round fishery. These are rockfish and flatfish that live on the bottom. They can be fished kind of anytime as long as the weather is okay. It's not like crab or salmon or things that are very seasonal. It was really the backbone of fishing activity that kept the ice house and the fuel dock and the processors there. And so when it collapsed, everything else kind of collapsed with it. So it was really the Fisheries Trust came together to hold this quota, to bring this quota back into the community for the benefit of fishermen who we hoped would come back in as the fishery recovered and the infrastructure came back in because the stocks were recovering and they could therefore go out and target these species again. That is still questionable, but that was the impetus for the trust to come together and for these groups to come together to say, okay, we need conservation, but we need to have production. We need a U.S. seafood model that works and feeds people here, because that's part of the economy. It's always been part of our heritage here in Monterey Bay, is to have some extraction from the ocean to support people.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Melissa Mahoney, Executive Director of the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust. And we've just been talking about the origins of the trust and the ways in which it tries to balance sustainability and fishing. And we were talking about quotas. Now, how did quotas get established in general and in the West Coast fisheries?
Yes. So kind of little fisheries 101, the kind of most simple traditional way that fisheries have been managed in the U.S. is the scientists figure out how many fish could be taken out in a fishing season. So that's your maximum sustainable yield. And then they take off a little chunk for uncertainty or, you know, to be precautionary. And then they set a catch limit. And then all the fishermen on day one go run out and catch as much as they can until it's done. And that has kind of been the traditional model. And in a lot of cases, that causes fishermen to race, you know, kind of race to the bottom. It's unsafe. It's caused derby fisheries. It's caused overfishing. It's caused bycatch, all kinds of problems. And so when the West Coast groundfish fishery had collapsed, the federal managers who were charged to figure out how do we make this a better fishery, it had tons of unintended bycatch because it was a multi-species fishery. And you had some species that had really low abundance and needed to be avoided, and they were mixed up with other highly abundant species. And so the fishery managers, excuse me, sort of took a play from the insurance industry, thinking about sort of risk pools and how to have individual ownership of these stocks to encourage more responsible management of each of the individual stocks. So the concept of a quota system where individual fishermen or permit holders own essentially a piece of the pie, instead of, you know, being just saying go out and get as much as you can until we close it, they actually own a share of the species for the fishery, and they can choose when and how to fish that. They can lease the quota if they're not going to use it. So it creates a marketplace for the resource, and the idea is that fishermen then they take ownership of that resource and they're going to care for it in a better way. And because it's going to be more valuable, the more fish there are, the more their quota shares are valuable, and the better off both they and the stocks are going to be. And so that is essentially the transition of this fishery into a catch share system in 2011 is how that quota share system came to be. And you had community quota funds that came into being to hold when the quota could not be owned by a single person for various reason. Maybe there weren't fishermen left in that community that were groundfish quota holders. That's what happened both in Morro Bay and in Monterey. There were very few fishermen left who could afford to buy quota or to even fish the quota. So community quota funds were a way for a community to come together and pool resources and secure those fishing rights in that place, because there was also a certain amount of consolidation going on at the time. And a lot of the bigger companies and the bigger boats up north in Oregon and Washington, mainly in Oregon, a lot of that quota was getting purchased and sort of, you know, taken away, because this is a West Coast-wide fishery. So that's how community quota funds, that's sort of the promise, is that they keep the quota local. And then for the trust, we have a quota leasing policy where if you're a local fisherman, we lease the quota at a discount. And then if you're not local, but you want to land the fish locally, we also give a discount. And then anything that we can't lease or land locally, we will lease that on the open market. And that helps generate revenue for our organizations, our own sustainability.
That's interesting. So let me see if I can understand it. So the quota is the right to catch a certain volume of fish or number of fish, right? It's not
Yes.
it and so you own the right quota right and not the fish specifically. And it's interesting that you lease the quota, right? So I hadn't thought about that as a, you know, as a way of using it, because I was curious about what it meant when you said that the Nature Conservancy somehow acquired these fishery quotas. I start to sort of see how were the number of shares quotas in a fishery determined, and then how were those quota rights distributed among communities?
Yes, relatively simple answer to that, but it, you know, it can get complicated. So, when the fishery transitioned to the catch share program, they looked at the fishing history of each fishing permit. So each fisherman has to have a permit that they then go and operate their fishing business with out on their vessel. And so the amount of quota share that each permit holder was given initially tied back to their fishing history. So you had some folks that fish really hard and caught a lot of stuff, and they were given a lot of quota share. It was just relative to their fishing history. There was also, when this started, they created a 10% sort of off the top, 10% of all of the different fisheries quotas for what they called an adaptive management program. And that quota was to be distributed to communities that needed quota. But that program never really got off the ground. It was just was sort of too hard to run. And the community quota funds that were being established, they sort of filled the role of that. So for both the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust and the Morro Bay Quota Fund. Those organizations received quota from the Nature Conservancy. And I'll just tell you that the reason why the Nature Conservancy had all this quota is that years prior, they had done a really big transaction and they had actually purchased 13 groundfish trawl permits. And so when the fishery transitioned into a catch share system, all of the quota assigned to those 13 permits became owned by the Nature Conservancy. And they never wanted to be in the fishing business. It
yeah,
wasn't,
I can
that
imagine.
Wasn't their goal. So they had 3 years to get under, there were individual species limits and cumulative limits. So that's why these trusts, the Morro Bay Fund and the trust, and actually some other smaller trusts up north, the Nature Conservancy helped to get those groups standing up and incorporated so that they could divest the quota back in. They had sort of already completed their habitat protection goals through that previous transaction. And now this quota being reinvested into the communities was sort of in their way. It was kind of coming full circle and giving that quota back in the hopes that as the groundfish fishery was revitalized and became sustainable, which it was designated, I think it was in 2014 or 2015 by the Marine Stewardship Council, which is an eco certification. They designated the West Coast groundfish fishery as a sustainable fishery. And that was a huge milestone and success story for this fishery that had collapsed 15 years prior and had overfishing and massive bycatch and habitat damage and all kinds of things, to have 15 years later have it be deemed sustainable by the Marine Stewardship Council, and to have these quota funds, and to have all of the stocks recovering. Two were recovering and the rest had been recovered, officially recovered. So it's really a conservation success story. The troubling part that the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust and many others are still trying to work on, though, is that the economic performance, the economic recovery didn't come. The conservation recovery did, but the economic recovery, we're still trying to get that back on footing. And I can talk more about that, but I'll pause and see
yeah well,
if that all made sense.
No, it did. Well, it's made sense to me. I mean, are the quotas designated for specific species, or
yes,
so tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, so the groundfish trawl fishery is, and I'm saying trawl, T-R-A-W-L, so those are the boats that tow the nets behind and they fish just a little bit off the bottom. Sometimes they hit the bottom. We can talk about that in a moment, but they're fishing just off the bottom for the flatfish and the rockfish. There's somewhere around 90 species of different kinds of fish that are managed in this fishery under the fishery management plan. Good. But there's a set of 30.
Question. How large is the fishery? Is it West Coast now, or is it?
Yes, it's
Central. Okay.
California, Oregon, and Washington. It's a federally managed fishery, and it has four sectors for the quota system. I'm only talking about the trawl fishery. So you have another hook and line, a long line fishery. You have a recreational fishery. You have an open access commercial fishery that's for small boats, and there's a tribal fishery. So the quota system was implemented for the trawl fishery, which was the largest by volume and effort in the groundfish fishery.
Okay.
So the way that they divided it up is they looked at all these, 90 species, and they said, okay, which of these are the most valuable and the most targeted and the most that we need to keep our eyes on? And then for the ones that didn't need to be in their own category, they grouped them. So, for example, we have sablefish. We have lots of different species of rockfish, and some are on their own because they're high volume and they are targeted. So, bacacio rockfish, chili pepper, widow, many others. And then you have a grouping of rockfish from the slope, rockfish nearshore, rockfish, rockfish on the shelf. So, it probably sounds strange. There's a lot of science behind it. And there are some great people at NOAA Fisheries who could probably talk about this way more eloquently than me, but in short, there are 30 different categories of IFQ, individual fishing quota species or species groups, where ownership can take place.
So the quotas that you have that you lease, are they for specific species, or are they for various different species?
Both. We own quota share across those 30 categories at various levels. Some species we don't own any of. We got what we got from the Nature Conservancy, and then we did one other deal with a local fisherman. So we don't have one of everything, but we have chunks of some species or species groups
Well, it
that
sounds
we lease out.
extraordinarily complicated. You know,
It
it's
kind of is.
run out and find me an artificial intelligence. You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Melissa Mahoney, Executive Director of the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust. And Melissa has just been explaining what is a very, very complicated quota system for fisheries on the West Coast, but which has basically led to the restoration of West Coast fisheries because it puts limits on the catch. Now, I got that right, yeah?
Well, I would just one small correction in that it is specifically for the groundfish trawl fishery. There's no
Okay.
other fishery on our West Coast that is managed with quotas.
I see. Okay. So basically the guys who are pulling in a lot of fish and bycatch kind of thing.
Rock
Right.
rockfish and flatfish are the main components of that fishery, and they used to have a lot of bycatch. They now the bycatch in that fishery was reduced by 90% between when it was closed in 99 and between when it was recovered in, let's say, 2013, I think is when I saw that statistic. So the implementation of the catch shares fishery, which required the fishermen to be accountable for everything that they caught or even threw back, was basically like they have a piggy bank account for every pound of fish that they catch, and there is a human observer on every trip they take. So they are accountable 100% for everything they catch, and that forced them to innovate and do something about this the bycatch problem, the wasteful bycatch, and they did.
I have actually a sort of orthogonal question here. As I recall, the recent decision by the Supreme Court to overturn, the Chevron
Yes.
policy had to do with observers on boats off of Maine or something like that, right?
Yes,
And
it did.
the fishers have to pay the costs of the observers. I think that was the issue. So how might that impact this fishery?
Yeah, I have yet to talk to one of the fishermen about since that the Chevron deference case was decided. And my understanding is that the what was the crux of that was, if a law gets made, Congress makes a law, and then they say, okay, agency X, who manages that area, you decide what how to implement that law. You know best. We're not gonna
Right,
give you all
right.
the details. And so in US fisheries, the move is to have more monitoring because it does two things. It helps managers collect data on the species that they are
Right.
trying to manage, and that and more data is better when you're trying to understand how many fish are out there. And secondly, it's also a compliance issue. So if there is monitoring on a boat, whether it's a camera or a human observer, the fisherman has to be accountable for whatever they're catching or whatever they're throwing back. And so it creates more efficiency and compliance in the fisheries. And the question about the burden of management of the observer coverage is a really interesting question, because on the East Coast, there is also a catch share fishery for groundfish. because they had a collapse in 94. You may re remember when all the cod collapsed in the 90s. They also moved to a catch share program. It's different than ours, but it's a similar concept. And they also had to, well, they didn't have as strict of an observer coverage requirement. They didn't have a 100% monitoring requirement like we do in the West Coast. They also have some congressmen on the East Coast who managed to get appropriations to cover any of the observer costs that they have. Whereas on the West Coast, the fishermen out here were given, I think it was 3 years, where the government subsidized the cost of monitoring, and then they proportionally put the burden on fishermen. And since, I think it's since 2015, the West Coast fishermen have re been required to pay 100% of those observer costs, which, and it's an average of 500 a day for a human observer. It's probably more now with inflation, but that was kind of the average, was 500 a day. Or they had to buy the cameras to install electronic monitoring. And so this case, this decision, I'm guessing it probably gives the fishermen some cover to go back to the government and say, look, this is, if management is requiring this amount of monitoring, then management needs to find a way to pay for it. But I have not heard any conversations yet about from West Coast fishermen on what they might do with this information. But I guess if I were them, I'd be thinking about it and thinking about how it pertained to me and the cost that I was having to incur to be able to go fish.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier about that the story is a conservation success, but not necessarily an economic one. So can you explain for the audience why that is the case? What's going wrong?
Yes, I can. Well, I can point to some really key factors. So when the groundfish fishery collapsed in the early 2000s or the late 90s, early 2000s, another species of whitefish was coming on hot to the US market. Any guess what it was? Tilapia. So
Okay.
tilapia and other whitefish that basically replaced the rockfish and sole that were no longer being caught in those first few years. They just simply got replaced by a different species. And you could say that the, you know, sort of the palate of the US consumer, you know, as long as it's a decent tasting, or actually really not a very mild flavor, flaky whitefish, I think a lot of US consumers don't really care where it comes from as long as it's the right price and it tastes pretty good and you can do whatever you want with it. So that was the first blow, is that when the fishery was closed, all these other whitefish took its place in the market.
And
And when
were these tilapia from fish farms?
Yes, tilapia is a farmed species.
Okay.
There's also catfish, you know, bassa catfish. You also had some of the really high volume fisheries up in Alaska, like for pollock and other Pacific cod and things, that there was just a lot of replacement. And so consumers didn't really miss this. It just got replaced. And then when the fishery came back, and especially when it was MSC certified, like I had said, it got the certification in 2014 or 2015. There was really this hope in, you know, those that had fought it out and remained in the fishery and managed to transition to this catch share system. The capacity in the fishery was reduced by at least 100 vessels, and so the vessels that remained thought, okay, we're going to come back in. We're going to get more. We're going to get paid more for our fish. We're going to get our markets back. All these great things, and they just couldn't compete with what was already there. Also, especially in California, in that about 10 years of time, the infrastructure in all of our ports and harbors in California just essentially went away. It wasn't supported because that fishery wasn't happening. So you had, you know, fuel docks and ice houses and processors and markets. They just kind of quietly went away and had to go, you know, do other things or leave that area. So the infrastructure went down. The competition for, you know, whitefish went up. And then you have operating costs going up and basically fishermen getting the same price for their rockfish and sole as they've been getting, you know, in the 80s and 90s. And it's just been kind of upside down and they haven't been able to get a foothold, especially in California. It's a little bit of a different story in Oregon. There's more boats, there's more infrastructure, there's more processing capacity and market capacity. And so the Oregon trawl fleet is doing better than we are down here. And so, especially in California, it just hasn't come back like many of us had hoped. And so that's part of why the Fisheries Trust, although we sort of started as a quota leasing organization to help revitalize this one fishery, we really evolved to look at and see how we could help all the fishermen and fishing businesses, whether they were salmon or crab or, you know, starting this community seafood program, just trying to evolve alongside the needs of fishermen, because these were bigger problems with the groundfish fishery than our little organization could really help with.
I see. How do you then try to facilitate a larger consumer base, I guess, for these fisheries and fish, right? I mean, because you want to get customers, consumers to buy more, you know, local sustainable fish. So what sorts of things do you do to try and stimulate that market?
We do as much as our small organization can handle. We are only three staff, but we have a strong social media presence, just like everybody does now. We're trying to get the word out on social media about whenever there's dock sales or about our local community supported fisheries, our fishing businesses that are sourcing and selling local fish. We also have a series of dinners where we partner with local restaurants and chefs to highlight certain species. And we have a dinner, and that is also a way that we fundraise for our community seafood program. And we invite a fisherman to come, and people get to have a Q&A and have a direct conversation with a real live fisherman, which is usually pretty fun and lively. We have a local catch guide on our webpage that we're updating as regularly as possible to highlight the markets and the restaurants and the places where you can find local seafood. So we're doing, you know, all the kinds of communications and marketing and events that we can do with our small team. But I will honestly say that it's hard. There's a lot of noise out there, as you know. And there's so much more I wish we could do. I wish we could have an annual seafood festival here in Monterey Bay. That really gets a lot of people coming to the harbors and celebrating our local seafood and really celebrating our fishermen, the men and women who go out and risk their lives to bring that fish back to us. They're really the bridge to this food source. There's not very many of them left. So I wish there was more we could do to really impress upon those of us that have the privilege and the honor of living around Monterey Bay, that it's so important to, for example, right now, choose California halibut. Go wherever you can find California halibut, because that's most of what the fishermen are able to catch right now, because there's no salmon. The rockfish fishery has some limits on it, for a reason I'm not even going to go into, because it's almost done. Yeah, I wish there was more that we could do, but we're doing everything we can to get the word out, that just like your local farmer's market and your local farmer, supporting your local fishermen is what gives us the breadth and depth of the delicious food that we get to have around here.
Sounds like you need an app.
Well, yeah. I don't know. There's been a lot of apps in the fisheries world trying to connect people with where to find fish, and it's so dynamic. It's hard to it's hard to pin it down.
Sure.
But maybe we could talk about that. If there's anybody out there that is hearing what our challenge is and wants to offer a solution or an idea, I would love to get the help and love to hear it.
You're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz, your host, and my guest today is Melissa Mahoney, Executive Director of the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust. And we've just started to talk about, I guess, the problem of marketing local fish and informing consumers where to get them. Question: A supermarket or a market has a fish department. How do they get their fish? Do they go out and look for local fish? Are there distributed? I think you mentioned aggregators at some point, aggregators and distributors. What's the actual mechanism whereby local fish, get out into the, besides these dockside sales, how else does the fish get out there?
Well, the short answer is it depends. It depends on the size of the grocer business or the restaurant business. If you're a Whole Foods or a Safeway or a big retail chain, those corporations have central distribution points where everything that's going into, let's say, the California Whole Foods stores or the West Coast region, all that stuff is going to a central distribution site, and it's meeting all of their standards for quality and freshness. And maybe they have some sustainability criteria that they need to meet as well. And then those that product gets, put on a truck and shipped every which way to every which store. There's no way for the local, like our local Whole Foods store here in Santa Cruz. I remember going to them when they opened and said, "Oh, I'm so excited! Our salmon fishermen, like they're going to be ready to bring you their catch in a month." And the guy was like, "I can't just take fish. They can't just like pull up to the back and give me that fish. It's like a whole system." And so maybe the other side of that is we have a small local grocer in Santa Cruz and Watsonville called Staff of Life. And they have just two stores, and they're family owned, and they work with all different kinds of seafood distributors. And I don't want to speak for them because I only know enough to be dangerous about their procurement, but I know they buy from some of the bigger distributors. And also from, smaller distributors who are really trying to get that local product straight to them, because obviously that's the shortest distance and that's the freshest. If, say, it came from Santa Cruz Harbor and it got driven right over to Staff of Life. I'm not sure how much of that is happening, but it really just depends on the size of the business, how many steps in the chain they need to go. And that's why the business that we really try and promote, because not as many people know, they think, okay, I'm going to go to Costco or Safeway or New Leaf to get my fish. And on all those groups do a great job, and they try and have their information. But there are these businesses called community supported fisheries, and we have three of them in Santa Cruz, probably the most of most places. And those businesses buy directly from local fishermen. Sometimes they buy further afield in California if they can't fill all their orders by what's caught locally. And then if you're an individual consumer household like myself or you can become a member of one of
I
those
see.
CSFs, and it's just like a farm box, but it's your fish share. And they either deliver it to your door, or you go to a neighborhood distribution site and there's a cooler there, and once a week or every other week you go and you pick up your bag of fresh locally caught fish, and it's got the name of the fisherman and the name of the vessel that it came off. And it's a way to guarantee that you are actually getting local fish.
Does this arrangement generate any significant income for the fishers?
Well, this is sort of what I hear around the on the edges. I mean, it's still transactional between the CSF trying to run its business
Right.
and generate some profit. But what I understand is that the kind of customer that they get is willing to pay more for that fish because they know
Yeah.
it's local, and so they are able to give a higher price to the fishermen. Because it can get that can get captured in the because there's basically only two or maybe three steps in that supply chain versus
Right.
your kind of typical supply chain where the fisherman gets paid very little because you have 10 middlemen going up the chain and it gets to us and we're still paying $30 a pound for that salmon or that, you know, whatever that is when it gets to our grocery store, but the fishermen got very little of that. So in this smaller this model where you're having one aggregator buy from the fishermen, that fisherman is getting more, he's capturing more value for his catch than if it were going up and up and up the chain.
Yeah, I see. I got it. How many boats are there going out of the Monterey Bay at this point?
Well, so I get asked this a lot, and
I'm sure.
I try and keep tabs on this a lot because it really is one of the most important measures of the well-being of the fishing community. And I would say there's less than 100 commercial vessels left in the bay that are really going out with any consistency. And since we lost this is the second year where there's been no salmon fishery.
Yeah.
I would say that the number of active vessels, the active fishermen is, and I'm not going to include the purse seine fleet. They're not active right now either because there's very little anchovy or squid in Monterey Bay. So that could change really anytime when the squid decide to show up here. But for our small boat fleet that target groundfish, salmon, crab, I would say right now, because of the salmon closure, there's probably less than 30 boats that are active on a weekly basis. It's
Wow.
very small.
So it's very small. And
Yeah.
does that mean that the quotas don't get filled?
Yes. We at the trust and a lot of other quota funds, we do not lease. Well, there's not a well, we never lease all of our quota. There's a lot of quota that is people are not fishing it because there's not a market for it. But in terms of other fisheries that don't have catch shares quotas, but just have, you know, orders to fill or, you know, trip limits to fill. I think halibut is being California halibut is being targeted heavily right now. So I'm guessing that the trip limits for that are pretty full. But I know in the other sector for ground fish called the open access fleet, they target sablefish and some other species, but I know that they're not fully utilizing their sablefish. They have bi-weekly or bi-monthly. I'm sorry, there's so many regulations I can't even keep up, but I think it's bi-monthly trip limits, and they are not I think they have not been fully meeting their trip limits either for various reasons.
So, I mean, it's really the same problem that affects everyone in the food system. If you're a small operation, it's easy to get trampled by the big ones. How can our listeners learn more about and participate in your activities? You mentioned a dinner.
Yes. So we have several dinners a year, usually about once a month, and we have a couple more coming up. In fact, next Wednesday night, August 7th, we are having a dinner at Saltwood Restaurant, which is in Marina, right off Reservation Road, near the Sanctuary Beach Resort. They're a fairly new restaurant, and so we're having a great dinner there with them on Wednesday, August 7th. Please join us, and we have information on our website for how you can buy tickets. And then in September, we are having our 10-year anniversary seafood celebration in Monterey at the Memory Garden. It's a Sunday afternoon and it's going to be a ball. We're going to have lots of different types of local seafood to taste and a silent auction and music. And if you've never been to the Memory Garden in Monterey, it's this beautiful old historic adobe. It's part of the state park system, and we hope that anyone and everyone is invited to attend. We have tickets online that can be purchased on our website, and we have early bird pricing through August 15th. And then the other thing I want to encourage people to do is, even if you can't make it to one of our events, just look for local seafood where you can get it. If you live near Monterey, you can often get, this time of year in the summer, you can get fresh halibut off the boat on Fridays and Saturdays. And you can sign up with the Monterey Harbor office to receive notification of when the fishermen are going to be delivering. Same thing in Santa Cruz. There are some boats that sell off the boat in Santa Cruz Harbor. And if you follow us on social media, we repost when those fishermen are doing their thing. And so if you follow us, you'll be able to get in the flow of when certain fishermen are bringing back. Albacore will start happening pretty soon here in the fall. There's still halibut, there's rock crab in Santa Cruz Harbor. So make it a fun challenge. If you have never tried anything local or you've never been to one of our local harbors, they also sell fish consistently in Moss Landing Harbor. The boat Vetisha sells fish. So there's lots of opportunities. They're just a little hard to find, especially right now because we don't have a salmon season. The fisheries are down in terms of the volume of what they're catching, but it is still out there, and they do need our support more than ever.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time, but this has been a very interesting conversation. And I want to thank you for being my guest on Sustainability Now.
Thanks, Ronnie. It's been great to talk with you.
You've been listening to a Sustainability Now interview with Melissa Mahoney, Executive Director of the Monterey Bay Fisheries Trust. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksquid.org/sustainabilitynow. As well as Spotify, YouTube, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. So thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make K-Squid your community radio station and keep it going. And so until next, every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.